FM UK. Today on the stream, we have a special episode with the author Haroon Mogal. He's also a commentator about Muslims and Islam affairs. And he has been a guest on the stream way back to the days when we used to have an orange sofa in the studio. His latest book is called 2 Billion Caliphs. And that is why we want him to be in the studio with us today, part of our conversation. Haroon, welcome back. So good to see you. You describe yourself sometimes as making Muslimness your trade. When did that start? How did that start?
It started when I grew up. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, then in Connecticut, and I was pretty much the only brown kid, certainly the only Muslim kid, and everyone wanted an explanation about anything and everything we did that was a little bit different. And that just became kind of second nature, I think, for a lot of American Muslims and folks who are minorities. That's just something we do all the time. And then, unfortunately, after September 11th, that became something we had to do and felt compelled to do. And really, it's been the passion of my life and the focus of so much of my work for pretty much the last 20-something years.
Yeah. The way I often see you, Haroon, is because you talk about issues around Muslims and Islam, and you're accessible and you break things down. I feel a little bit like when a doctor goes for a party and people say, oh, I've got a bad back. And so you go somewhere and people start asking you about Islam. And Haroon, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Are you comfortable having that role?
Well, my favorite part about that analogy is that I grew up in a South Asian community in the United States where pretty much everybody other than me was a doctor. So nobody quite knew what to do with me. And the upside to that is that nobody ever looks at you during a fundraiser. They kind of just look the other way because they figure, oh, that's a writer. Probably aren't going to be donating to anything here. But it is something I think that we should be comfortable with. I know there is a narrative out there that it's incumbent, it's an obligation on people to go find information. But I think when you're a minority, it's really a privilege and an honor and a responsibility to try to tell the stories that people might not have access to and change the narrative and change the story.
I'm so glad you said that, because we have a YouTube audience right now that online, the comment section is available for our audience to talk to you directly. They've got thoughts, questions for you, comment sections right here. Haroon, I will bring some of their thoughts to you. You have a journey, and I feel in 2 Billion Caliphs that I take that journey with you from where you were as a kid to where you are now. Incredible maturity. When you were a youngster, you practiced Islam and you did what you were told. And now, in this book, you're understanding what it was that you were told and putting it in a contemporary setting. Tell me about that journey, why you wanted to share it.
I heard a lecture a few weeks back by a professor, an educator, who said that in this day and age, we have this obsession with cramming information into the kids' heads, that we want them to know all these facts and all these dates and all these timelines, when we ourselves don't even know where the world's going to be in 10 years or 15 years, and we don't even know if any of that information is going to be relevant. And what we should be doing is we should be giving them resilience, confidence, a feeling like they can figure things out for themselves. And I think what I really feel blessed by in my upbringing is that my parents really tried to make me feel like I could handle the obligations of being a Muslim in America on my own. And it took me a long time, and there were a lot of failures and mistakes along the way. But I feel like I've reached a point where I am comfortable contributing on my own terms and in my own ways to communities, and I want to pass that on. And that's really the underlying impetus, not just behind the book, but behind everything I do, is this idea that really we don't know what the future is going to look like. And if we want our faith and our traditions and our values to go on beyond us and to advance ahead of us, then the people who carry them have to be able to survive without us.
Mustafa Akyol has read your book. It came out in April, so he's one of the earliest readers. And he has a question for you. I'm going to play that question. And as soon as you see the video finish, please answer it immediately. Here's Mustafa.
I really love this book, 2 Billion Caliphs by Haroon Mogal. It's a delight to read, really. Besides all the information and all the history, it's just a great prose. And I have a question to Haroon. You use the term caliphs, 2 Billion Caliphs, which may shock people because they may think of caliphate as a political institution, but you're referring to Muslim individuals as caliphs. So what do you mean by that? Like, are you trying to transform a political vision into a more individualistic vision of Islam? I would be sympathetic to that, but I'm really happy to learn what you exactly mean by that.
So I think Mustafa absolutely hits the nail on the head. Caliphate and the use of the term caliphs in the title was a little bit intended because I knew it would stop people in a bookstore and potentially when browsing and say, wait a minute, what does that mean? It's a term that unfortunately, but understandably, has some really negative resonances, given especially the events of the last 10 years or so. And caliphate is associated with not just a political institution, but a really violent and authoritarian form of political institution. But digging into the history of Islam and the source texts of Islam, I found that the first mention of caliphs and caliphates is actually in the story of Adam and Eve. And to put it really succinctly and really simply, basically the Muslim conception is that every single human being, male and female, from the beginning of our species to the end of our species, regardless of religion, regardless of wealth or class or creed or color, every single individual is a caliph, which is just an Arabic word that originally means something like a steward, someone who acts on someone else's behalf. And so we're all tasked by God to live out and to build a better world. And so, yeah, it is a kind of political vision, but it's a destabilizing one and a democratic one. It's let's take power away from hierarchies and dynasties and authorities that enrich and empower themselves at everyone else's expense. And let's say, no, authority morally and ethically actually belongs to every single person. And that's the kind of world we should be constructing as Muslims and with people of other faiths or no faiths.
Something that strikes me, Haroon, in your work and how you talk about Islam is how much you respect women, how important they are in the Muslim faith, and you basically write as a feminist. So in 2 Billion Caliphs, you rethink the stories of some key women in Islam whose stories seem to be just pushed to the background. What do you think Hajar would think about this? What do you think it was like to have to leave your baby in the desert and go look for water? And you're thinking about it not from the man's perspective, but from the woman's perspective. That is quite radical. You're questioning the whole way Islam is framed from a patriarchal perspective and making it more feminist.
Yeah, and it's something that I suppose beautifully enough and fittingly enough, in the time since the book was finished and went into publication, I got married and became a stepfather. And there's three kids in my life, two of whom are teenage girls. And it becomes apparent to me in a very intense and visceral way on a daily basis, what are the ways in which we exclude and include people? And when we say we want every single person in our community to feel like they have a stake in the community, does that include everyone, regardless of how they identify? Again, gender, obviously, as you pointed out, is immensely significant in terms of how Muslim communities organize themselves and include and exclude people. But not only that, race, class, ethnicity, worldview, Sunni, Shia, all those sort of things. And so one of my hopes of this book is, yes, let's look at these stories from those perspectives, but let's encourage everyone to try to look at stories and see themselves in the different actors and narratives in those stories so that we find more meaning and more applicability and more relevance in those stories, not just in terms of what happened 1400 years ago, which of course is very important, but in terms of what's happening right now. How do these stories speak to us and what do they mean for us in our future?
Haroon, would you mind telling us one of those stories just briefly? Because I did a very inelegant summary, but I was drawn into thinking about this is classic Islam, also where the faiths cross, actually, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. So there are lots of the characters that I already knew. But you rethink the story from a female perspective. Give us an example.
So the story that you alluded to, I think, is a perfect one. Hagar, who's the wife of Abraham, and Abraham, of course, is the sort of founding figure of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and he's pretty well known among those faith traditions, but Hagar not so much. And one of the most famous stories and formative stories in the Islamic tradition is that Hagar is abandoned by Abraham with their infant son, Ishmael, or Ismail in Arabic, peace be upon them all. And she's left in the valley that later becomes Mecca with basically no food, no shelter, no resources of any kind. And essentially, because God believes that she is up to the task of handling this moment. And I found two things particularly poignant and beautiful about that story. The first is that really that chapter, the founding story of Islam, begins with Abraham leaving and Hagar having responsibility for Ishmael and for what happens next. And not only making sure that they're rescued, but making sure that a civilization grows up around them that incubates them and protects them and honors their values. And so she goes from a person who's, you know, very much on the margins to a person who's basically deciding the fate of a civilization. And the final part of the story that I found particularly beautiful is that actually Hagar is buried outside the Kaaba, which is the black cubical shrine that Muslims pray towards, which is at the center of the great mosque in Mecca, which probably many of people have seen when, for example, you see video clips of the Hajj pilgrimage, so on and so forth. She's actually buried there. And I thought that story was so beautiful because when I was growing up, we were often told or saw around us that women were not allowed in cemeteries or at funerals for various patriarchal reasons, so on and so forth. And they were entirely excluded from probably, you know, one of the most meaningful moments in any person's life, one of the most painful but meaningful moments in any person's life. And yet here in Mecca, at the heart of Islam, at the very feet of every single pilgrim who comes, and we're talking about millions and millions of people, is buried Hagar and Ishmael. And that, I think, is such a powerful vision of the story of Islam, going from two people alone in a desert to millions and millions and millions of people inspired by their journey and motivated by their faith and trying to retrace their footsteps time and time again.
We got in touch with Umar Lee, and he has a question for you. This is what he sent to us a few hours ago.
Harun Mogul's book, I really enjoyed it. It's part of the growing body of literature from Muslims in America discussing the Muslim experience, particularly the second generation coming of age tale. It was touching, it was authentic, it was honest, and I recommend this book. Particularly how he was authentic in his struggles with religion and family, which is something people need to open up about. So the question I have is for Harun is, did you write this with the intent of opening up the dialogue for Muslims in the West to discuss family issues and struggles with faith?
Well, first I'll say it's really nice hearing from Omar, and one of the things I love most about his writing, among many things, is that he's honest and fearless, and he just says exactly what needs to be said, and maybe it makes people uncomfortable, but we're much better off for the fact that we have people like him in our communities who are willing to challenge us on our received stereotypes. And I think he's exactly right. I feel like in my own life, I made a lot of mistakes and I struggled with a lot of received wisdom about faith and about my own role as a man, as a Muslim, as a community leader, as a religious authority in some ways, and never really was able to figure that out because there weren't really enough resources and spaces where people talked about stuff like that. So my hope is, yeah, let's have some difficult conversations. And if you believe something is true and beautiful and valuable, then people will come back to it. Maybe not in the way that I did it or that my parents did it, but they will come back to it. They will find inspiration in it because ultimately these are the stories that nurture us and inspire us and connect us. And if we have space to have those conversations, we also take away one of the greatest challenges that young people of faith face, which is sometimes they feel like their challenges are so unique that there's something wrong with them, that it simply can't be possible that anyone else might share the same doubts or frustrations that they share. And if you inhabit that kind of place internally, it's really psychologically damaging and devastating. And if instead you see like, hey, actually, you know, a lot of people are struggling with this, then, you know, you realize you're just a human being. And maybe if I could write another book, it's, you know, you're a person, not a robot, right? We're not designed to simply inhabit a religious subroutine and do everything right every single step of the way. You can just ask me about this month of Ramadan and how many ways I fell flat on my face. And I'm sure.
How many ways? How many ways did you? Let's count the ways.
If I can be honest here, so
yeah, please.
Muslims will immediately understand this. But last night was the 27th night, and it was many Muslims, especially Sunni Muslims, consider it the most sacred night, not only of Ramadan, but of the entire year. It's called the Night of Power. And I was actually traveling promoting the book the last few days and didn't go to the mosque where I was based the last few days because I wanted to get my rest and I wanted to make sure I could spend the whole night at the mosque. And, you know, among the many things that went wrong, I mean, one was actually just absolutely comic that I finally made it into the mosque far later than I wanted to get there. And I entered the prayer and there's a special supplication that's at the end of the Tarawih prayer services where the imam and the whole congregation, we really just open up our heart and our soul and just beg God for forgiveness and for all the things we need and we want. And I'm sitting there and I'm in the middle of this incredible moment. And then one, the microphone goes off and no one can hear anything anymore. And then nobody knows what to do because we're all frozen in prayer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, this is not what I expected. And then out of nowhere, because this is how my brain works, I was like, wait, did I do wudu? Like, did I do my ablutions before I got here? Like, is my prayer even valid? And there's probably 700 people here and there's probably 50 people in line to get to the bathroom. So does that mean my prayer doesn't count? And I mean, that's basically my 27th night was spent in like one minor disaster after another. But you realize that that's life, right?
Right.
It's just at different times in your life, you're at different places and there's different realities. And that's the messiness and beauty of faith.
Picking up on the messiness of faith, you wrestle and you share some of the biggest, most controversial hot topics in Islam, which started in classic Islam and then trying to make it work for contemporary Islam. War, human sexuality, slavery, why it's one of my favourite chapters in your book is called Adam and Eve and Eve and Eve and Eve. I laughed a lot, but I know where you were going with that. How are people reacting to you taking some of the trickiest topics in Islam and trying to make them make sense in 2022? Are people liking it or pushing back?
Well, one of the most interesting responses I got was someone who read the book and concluded that I had come down hard on conservative positions on Islam and sexuality, when I thought that I actually attempted a very nuanced, balanced attempt of saying, look, there are different ways of looking at these issues. And as the world moves into the 21st century and progressive ideas become more common and proliferate across Muslim spaces, what we really need to do is come to terms with the fact that we will have different interpretations and we have to learn how to coexist with those different interpretations. I tried very hard to be respectful of the immense sensitivities involved and the immense complexities involved. And I think I was so successful that I basically argued myself into both positions in the minds of many readers who I think sometimes people will see what they want to see. What I'm trying to say instead is that actually the most important thing Muslims can do is be honest about what their texts do and do not say. So the fact is, yes, in early Islamic history, Muslims did practice slavery. Although, as I argue, their understanding of what it was supposed to be was a radical revision of how the institution had been understood. Of course, over time, tragically and inexcusably, that revision was entirely lost, and the institution not only resurfaced, but became even more violent and venal and more of an enormity. And so that was a failure on the part of Muslim communities. When it comes to sexuality, I think in the last few decades, Muslim communities have seen themselves in many respects moving in a different direction from a lot of mainstream Western society, as well as other currents and other cultures across the world. And that's going to present a major challenge. And I don't have a solution to that, because the problem, as I lay it out, is that on the one hand, we are dealing with people's most intense needs, basic human needs for intimacy, companionship, and partnership as they understand it and desire it. And on the other hand, at the heart of the Muslim tradition is this idea that God and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, define what is and is not acceptable morally within, you know, there is space for interpretation and reinterpretation and so on and so forth. But broadly speaking, that's what it is. And if you challenge that, you're not just challenging a specific issue. You're basically saying that the founding principle of Islam is no longer in operation.
Yes.
And what you're doing is you're destabilizing the entire faith. Now, is it possible that someone may find a way out of that conundrum? Certainly, I don't think I'm that intelligent that I've imagined every single possible interpretation or approach to an issue. What I'm trying to do is lay out the stakes in the spirit, ultimately, of saying, if we understand how intense the emotions and commitments involved are, we can, at the very least, respond to each other with sensitivity, with respect, with dignity. And this is another reason why in the book, over and over again, I say that we need political secularism, not cultural secularism, but political secularism. We cannot impose interpretations of faith on people who don't share those interpretations. We can create room for different interpretations. We can acknowledge that we won't always agree, but we certainly should never allow ourselves to be in a position where we are circumscribing people's life choices because they don't accord with how we understand faith.
Haroon, have a look at my laptop. See what's on it. Camera's coming to me any moment now. Okie dokie. All right, I feel like this is appropriate for the tone of your book because you go deep, you go serious, you're into classic Islam, you're doing analysis you're understanding the text of the Quran, and then up pops popular culture. Explain what is going on here.
Well, the first thing when you brought up Anakin Skywalker, the future of Darth Vader, I was just jealous of his hair.
And his eyeliner.
Coming back. And his eyeliner. My eyeliner is pretty good, but his hair has definitely got my hair beat. But what I really wanted to do was, I've been fascinated by this fact that we've, in American culture and probably around the world, we've found heroes and superheroes and comic book characters and science fiction so compelling. Mm. And I think it's because actually at bottom, and this is a very, a very universalist reading of religion, but I think it emerges from something consistent with Islam. At the end of the day, if I believe that every single human being was descended from Adam and Eve, and I believe that Adam and Eve were created to be caliphs of God, then I have to believe that every human being has the same baseline internal impulses for spirituality, for a connection to the divine, for a desire for a meaningful place in the universe that transcends the biological and the material. And so Star Wars, on the one hand, maybe to some people it just seems silly, but I actually think that one of the reasons it's so popular is that it picked up on these really deep human impulses at a time when belief in traditional religion was fading. And so people were looking for another way to translate their desire for seeing good and evil and heroism and sagas and epics in the world. And I actually argue that in some ways Star Wars helps us understand the story of Adam and Eve and the Caliphate, because Anakin Skywalker, this kind of tragic hero who goes from the promised chosen one into the epitome of darkness embodied, and then has... for spoiler alert, but I'm sure everyone already knows this, right? And at the very end, find some kind of redemption in the last moments of his life.
You ruined the series now. You ruined it, Haroon.
I ruined the series, but George Lucas did too with those prequels.
So don't get Haroon started now, because we'll have to have a whole show for what happened in Star Wars. One of my favorite lines from your book was, "The most dangerous Sith Lords often start out as the most promising Jedi." If you know Star Wars, that will make a lot of sense to you. One more comment for you, and this is from Asad Hussain. And simple question, what's the answer? Here he is.
Most of your writings so far have been autobiographical memoirs. So what's next for you? What's your vision for your next book, your next piece?
I was at Mount Holyoke College yesterday, and I was giving a presentation at an iftar dinner. It's the dinner that the meal that Muslims eat when they break their fast immediately after sundown or shortly after sundown, depending on the type of Muslim. And I gave a decent presentation, not bad, considering I had about 700 miles of air travel under my belt, and I was pretty dehydrated and tired. And then it came time to Q&A, and a woman in the back, and I can't remember her name, she raised her hand, and she had a great question. She said, "When things are tough, what gives you hope?" And I don't know if this is a book project per se, but I do think there's something there. What are ideas and stories and beliefs and commitments that give people strength in tough times? Because I do think that, of course, on an individual level, we all go through really, really, really difficult times. But on a collective level, we as a species are facing some enormous challenges from, of course, the pandemic, which is very much with us in many places of the world, to the terrible reality of climate change, racism, violence. We've got war in Ukraine that threatens to spill out of there. And how do we keep ourselves going in such a way that we can commit to tackling the really tough stuff without losing faith in each other and in ourselves? And I would like to explore Muslim answers to those questions, not because other answers don't matter, but because those are answers that I think we don't hear enough of, and I certainly don't think Muslims hear enough.
Oh, it sounds like you've got that book already ready to go. Let me show you where you can see Haroon's current book, and also follow him online on Facebook. 2 Billion Caliphs by Haroon Mogul, and the subtitle here is A Vision of a Muslim Future. Haroon Mogul, always a pleasure having you on the stream. Many thanks for joining us today. Take care.